we're talking about food banks and pantries and the work to end hunger in Wisconsin. It is the morning show on this Thanksgiving. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Food banks have taken on more responsibility in recent years, often helping their clients connect with challenges that go beyond food, like finding safe housing, affordable housing, finding medical care and child care. About 40 million Americans are food insecure, which means access to food is limited or uncertain. Do you rely on local food pantries? Does your community offer enough of them? How does it help you? How does it help your family? Are you part of a local food bank? Where do you distribute food and what is your role? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Ellen Carlson is Executive Director of Middleton Outreach Ministry. Her organization has been serving Middleton, Cross Plains, and the west side of Madison for nearly 40 years through food programs and related services. Ellen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So when we say food insecure, your clients come from so many different circumstances and situations, but what do you hear from your families that need food assistance? What is their situation like?
Yeah, you know, there's many different types of situations. You know, for some people, they are working several jobs. They might be working, you know, jobs that have very variable hours, and, you know, the kinds of jobs where they might have some hours some week and lots of hours the next. Those are, you know, unpredictable often. And so for some people, they're just not quite making enough money to make all of the things work. There's so many expenses that people have, and oftentimes they're looking for a way to either reduce expenses or just sort of stabilize. And so for a lot of people, that's where the food pantries come in. And for others, you know, they will be having a crisis of some variety where all of a sudden the savings that they had or things that they had kind of put aside to, you know, make things work, all of a sudden is gone. And that crisis is really sort of taking over and they need assistance. And I think one thing that often comes up for people is that, you know, the prices of housing in our community are very, very high. And for a lot of people, the majority of their paychecks are going towards that rent. And so then other things come up short.
How do your clients feel about asking for this assistance and coming to you?
Yeah, you know, I think there's sometimes people will ask things like, you know, if people can come and use the food pantry, you know, what... Why would they want to do that versus going to the grocery store? And my response always is, you know, if, because anyone can use the food pantry, the food pantries who take, or get food, I'm sorry, from the Community Action Coalition here locally, but through the Emergency Food Assistance Program, anyone who comes to us and says, you know, I don't make enough money, can use our services without necessarily having to show us any proof of income. And so then the question always is, well, can't just anybody use a food pantry? And my answer to that is always, people would rather go to the grocery store. They would rather go and have the variety of foods that they can choose. And so oftentimes when they come to us, they're not happy to be there. That is not the place that they would prefer to be getting the food for their families or for themselves. And so for us, it's really important to try and provide as dignified as an experience as possible and to make that trip to the food pantry as feel as much like a trip to the grocery store as possible.
We're talking with Ellen Carlson. She's Executive Director of Middleton Outreach Ministry, which serves people in need on Madison's west side, in Middleton and Cross Plains. You can join in. Does your family participate in food assistance programs in the state? Do you use SNAP or WIC benefits? How does it help you? Where do these benefits fall short and really not meet the reality on the ground for your family? Join in, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ellen, as you talk about how you make the pantry accessible and make it accessible and easy to access, today being Thanksgiving, how do you incorporate holiday foods at the food pantry?
Yeah. So, you know, like a lot of food pantries, we had a Thanksgiving basket type program where people could register and pick up sort of a full meal's worth of food all at once on a special day. So, you know, that included, you know, the turkey and kind of all the fixings for more of a traditional meal. But for us, it's also really important to have a lot of those kinds of items in our food pantry so that when people come to shop, they can get, I use that, you know, of course, that word shop, free shopping, but they come to shop as it's getting the ability to pick up kinds of foods that they want. And I think it's really important to remember that not everybody, you know, is interested in a turkey and stuffing. They often are looking for foods that are more traditional for their families. And so it's also important to us to try and fill the pantry as much as possible with those types of foods.
And when you say more traditional for your families, what specifically are you talking about?
For my family, right, we're eating a lot of things. A lot of people are eating turkey and cornbread and stuffing and all those kinds of foods. But, you know, for a lot of people, they are looking for different types of grains. They're looking for maybe foods to make, tamales and all kinds of different things. And we have people from so many different traditions who use the food pantry. For us, we really are trying as much as possible just to have as much variety on the shelves as possible so that we're not saying, today you're eating corn, because that's what we have for a vegetable. And that's true for us year round. That is something, of course, we look at during this time of year. But for us all around the year, we really want to try and have as many different types of foods as possible. People have different food needs. They have different health needs. They have different things that they enjoy. And just because someone has to use a food pantry to kind of create their meal doesn't mean they should have to give up the things that they know are good for them and their families.
What about produce? What types of produce are available at the pantry, and where, you know, how do you source that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So food pantries who have the ability to do refrigeration really try as much as possible to have produce, because as we all know, produce is very important for nutritious eating, and people enjoy it, and it's good for you. And so it's really important just to try and have that. And it is hard to source. There's no doubt about that. You know, living in Wisconsin, that produce becomes much easier in the summer. We have a garden actually where we grow a lot of our own food and produce so that we have a ready access to that. That is not something that every community can do, or not every food pantry is able to do. We also ask people in our community to grow vegetables and bring that produce in, because I think it's important to remember that a lot of food that ends up in food pantries actually comes through food banks and the greater food security system. So that can mean that by the time food comes to us, maybe it's already been to a grocery store, or it has, you know, been on a shipment across the state of Wisconsin, but isn't going to quite make it to wherever it needs to be before it's not good any longer. And so a lot of food and produce that food pantries get, it's kind of on the end of its life. So if you take some, say, produce home from the food pantry, 2 days later, it might already not be good to eat any longer. And if you're struggling and are using that food pantry services to make ends meet, that can be not the best choice, right? Because you might not have food 2 days later. And so for us, trying to get as much produce as early, sort of in that produce's cycle as possible, is always a goal. And we do that through a variety of different ways, like I said, through the gardens and through other people gardening, but also the food banks that we also source from, such as the Community Action Coalition and Second Harvest.
Yeah, we're going to pause right there with Ellen Carlson, who heads up Middleton Outreach Ministry. Your thoughts on your food bank, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the work and services of food pantries and efforts here in Wisconsin to fight hunger. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When we talk about food insecurity, it means that a person has limited or uncertain access to adequate food. And in our country, this living in the face of hunger, it affects nearly 40 million people. It includes one in five students at four-year universities. Do you volunteer at a local food pantry? How does it make you feel? What does your local food pantry offer? Is it meeting the needs in your community? And if you donate food, how often and what do you give? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ellen Carlson is the head of the Middleton Outreach Ministry, and she stays with us. Ellen, by the numbers, what is the need like that you see in Dane County for a food pantry? How many people do you serve?
Yeah, so there's, many food pantries in Dane County. We serve the west side of Madison, Middleton, and Cross Plains. We see about 65 households a day. We distribute about 1.3 to 1.4 million pounds of food every year. I know a lot of people will say, oh, but it's such an affluent community on the west side of Madison and Middleton. Is there really that much of a need? And if you look at the number of children who use free and reduced lunch, which means that the incomes of their families qualify for assistance with food during school, about a quarter of the kids who live in our communities are on free and reduced lunch. So that means about a quarter of the kids are struggling with instability in their homes, whether it is, not having access to food or housing or those kinds of things. So we know that there's quite the need. And about half of the people that we serve through the work that we do are children. So there's a great need in our community.
Have you seen those numbers pretty stable? Are we actually trying to reduce hunger here? Have you seen any change?
For us, our communities have grown a lot, and then changes in the Madison and Middleton communities have changed a lot. Housing has become really difficult. So I think when we talk about food security, it's really important, of course, to talk about the causes. And we talked about that a little bit, but rent keeps going up. Minimum wage hasn't really increased that much. Healthcare costs obviously are quite expensive for people. So those kinds of things together have created a situation where it's a pretty stable number of number of people we serve, but it's constant. Over the last years, it has we're consistently seeing those numbers, despite the fact that even us as an organization are really also helping to try and stabilize people's housing. And the other thing I did want to mention is that as a food pantry, we actually allow people to visit as often as they need to. And so for us, we look at it as a way to help stabilize a housing situation as well. So when people are really struggling, trying to make sure they can stay in their housing, because homelessness, of course, is so traumatic. And once you are homeless, it's very difficult to get back into housing, especially in our community. So we use the food pantry in that way and really encourage people to use it as much as possible if that is the thing that's helping stabilize their situation.
Well, let's bring in a call now. Chris is joining us from Adams. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I was homeless, and I also lived in Madison briefly, and I just want to compliment your guest because she really gets it, and a lot of places don't. I have food allergies big time. I also am a single person, which means that for my own, I've sort of stopped going to my food pantries up here because they just don't get it. And I have gone to the Central Wisconsin Executive Director of the CAC and said, something needs to be done about this. They won't let me make substitutions. Like, I can't get, six cans of peas instead of getting some hamburger helper or something like that because I can't eat it. And they won't do that for me. I can't get a can of coffee because I'm not considered a family. There's all kinds of really stupid rules.
So there are a lot of stipulations in how you can even access this food. I wonder, Ellen Carlson, is that a difficulty for people, especially if they have food allergies or are looking for something very specific? Can regulations and rules get in the way?
Of course they can. I mean, I think that their food pantries are constantly trying to weigh having enough food for everybody who comes in. But I think the caller makes a really great point that everybody needs something different. And a lot of times that need is something they want, which I think also should be, if we can, something that we think about, because food is something we all need to sustain ourselves. Food is what we need to go to work. Food is what we need to take care of our health. And so as many things as we can possibly do, but the systems are complicated. And I think we all need to really be thinking as a community and as a state about the things that we can do to assist people so they can get the things that they need.
We're talking with Ellen Carlson. She heads up the Middleton Outreach Ministry, which serves people in need on Madison's West Side and in Middleton and Cross Plains. You can join in. How are you connected to your community's food pantry? Do you volunteer? Do you make use of the programs? How much is your food bank used? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Ellen, I want to run this by you. We've been reading headlines that the current trade war between the U.S. and China is actually helping local food banks, that by the numbers, food pantries have taken in twice as much food from a federal distribution program. Have you noticed a ripple effect in any way where you are?
Yes, absolutely. So it's all complicated, right? But we have actually seen an additional amounts of food going into that emergency food assistance program because the government really wants to make sure that the food is being purchased, whether it's not going overseas, then if it's going to stay here, then we want to make sure it gets back out into the community. So we have seen that. I do know that there's been some challenges because the types of food that are coming through that program are foods that not all food pantries are able to handle. So the way a lot of food pantries work, right, is that some of them have refrigeration and freezers. We're grateful that when we rebuilt our food pantry about 6 years ago, we were able to add commercial refrigeration and freezers so that we can take more produce, we can take more dairy, we can take more meat. Not all food pantries can do that. And so it actually has caused kind of a systemic issue to solve, right, as to how to get that food throughout the state and to get it places where it won't go bad as food pantries try and deal with kind of that excess of food. And just a reminder, too, to everybody that food pantries really rely off of people, like individuals, to give them money. There's not, there are some grants, of course, but food pantries, they're being completely supported and run by volunteers in the community and by generous people who write checks and make donations of food. So, and it's awesome that we have all this extra food that's coming in through that emergency food assistance program, but food pantries need also help in being able to sort of manage that.
And the bulk of the work you do at your organization is really fueled by volunteers. You have well over 100 volunteers.
We do actually, and on a regular basis, we have about 400 volunteers who rotate in and out.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. And so we have staff whose jobs are really just to help manage those volunteer schedules and to make sure, you know, that the food safety regulations are being followed and to make sure that also they're providing as much of a good experience for our clients as possible. So it is a lot. And also, we could never do what we do without those volunteers. They are sometimes there in the morning before even staff are there getting things ready for the day. They're very incredible people.
I'm wondering what types of relationships that you forge with your clients, because they're there when they need you, and when they go away, that can sometimes mean a really good thing, a success for you.
Absolutely.
Do you ever see them again or hear from them many years later when they're doing well?
Sure. So we do hear from people. We hear from people all the time who say, you know, this was the thing that we needed. We, you know, were in crisis and we were able to receive these services and it really made a big difference. And a lot of times people don't need our services anymore, and they leave. And we actually, you know, like you said, well, there are people who we see on a regular basis and then wonder what happens to people. We're hoping that for the most part, that means that they don't need our services anymore. And that's, of course, fantastic.
You previously worked for AmeriCorps before becoming the head of the Middleton Outreach Ministry. What did you learn from AmeriCorps that serves you today to better understand food insecurity?
Yeah, so before I even started working at Middleton Outreach, I spent 2 years through the Schools of Hope program here in the Madison area. And one of our goals was to get more volunteers reading with kids. And I had an after-school program that I ran where basically volunteers came and read with children. And one of the things that always struck me is that there were, and I was young when I was doing this, and so I was very naive about how things work. And a lot of the kids would come and they would be ready to read, and they just couldn't do it at the end of the day. And through some of the relationships with some of those kids, as they kind of got to know and trust me and some of the other volunteers better, they would tell us that they were hungry, and that's why everything was a struggle. And it made me really realize that there are so many things that go into success for kids, for families, for everybody. And it's all of those things together that we really need to work on if we really want to make the change in our community.
Ellen, thank you for your work and for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Ellen Carlson is Executive Director of Middleton Outreach Ministry. Stay with us. We talk all things chocolate. You're listening to the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about where chocolate comes from and the complexities around how we source cocoa. That's the main ingredient in chocolate. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Most of the world's chocolate comes from Africa, specifically Ghana and Ivory Coast, where more than 2 million children work in hazardous conditions growing cocoa. And so big brands like Nestle and Hershey, they have programs to help improve farmers' lives. Did you know about human rights and environmental issues in the chocolate industry? Has it changed the way you shop for any chocolate? We're at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you to join in. Journalist Simran Sethi is the creator and host of The Slow Melt, which Saveur magazine named the best food podcast of 2017. And she's the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. Simran, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've talked with farmers in Ecuador. You've talked with a whole lot of cocoa farmers over the years. What have they told you about their work, their environment, what they do?
Well, you know, there's not one single expression of their lives. And I think that's really important because we oftentimes maybe think of people who are far away, who are growing these crops that we don't see growing in the ground as a monolith. And it's a very different experience for farmers, for example, in Ivory Coast and Ghana, who are growing commodity cocoa or cacao. The cacao is the pod-shaped fruit that is processed into cocoa and then is, of course, a primary component of chocolate. You know, they're growing it for some of those big chocolate companies like Mondelez, Nestle, and Mars. Then you have, farmers in Latin America that are growing what is known as fine or flavor cacao predominantly. And that's the more specialized cocoa that you'll find in, you know, what we call craft chocolate bars. But I think what's important to remember is that most of the cocoa that's grown in the world is grown by small farmers on small plots of land. And cocoa is a crop that is that needs kind of a mass to ferment. So we're seeing a lot of these farmers very quickly losing any control over what it is that they're growing. And what I mean by that is they will pass the cocoa on to a central, you know, fermentation and processing area. And then from there, you'll see the price, you know, increase. But the farm gate price, the price that farmers are receiving on the ground, is excessively low. It's between 3% and 6% of what we pay for a chocolate bar. And it's not improving despite the attention that's been placed on you know, the impoverishment of farmers.
So are the profits just going to the big companies then? Like where is the money going in that supply chain?
It disproportionately goes toward the end of the supply chain. So it is to the manufacturers, it is to retailers, and it's a price that's stayed steady. So if you think about the fact that cocoa is a really, you know, it's a commodity crop, the price is actually quite volatile. There was a tremendous price drop a couple of years ago. The price dropped by about a third, and we never saw the price of our chocolate bars going down, you know. So all of that then of course gets absorbed as profit for some of these major companies. And you know, it's not that they're not trying to address some of these challenges, but I think fundamentally, when we look at some of the biggest issues that we see in cocoa, you know, whether it's deforestation or extreme child labor, these are issues of poverty. If you're in a situation where, you know, you're going to need to cut down trees in order to grow a crop to sustain your livelihood, or keep your child out of school to, again, sustain your life and make sure those children are fed. I mean, these are not easy decisions, and these aren't ones that anyone wants to make. But the fact is that, you know, despite policy initiatives, despite a lot of talk from the industry, these problems are not going away. And in many instances, particularly around deforestation and extreme child labor, they're getting worse.
Well, before we talk about child labor, I want to go to Venezuela. You've spent some time there as well. And Venezuela isn't just in turmoil, but they have what's known as the Criollo coffee beans, which are really highly coveted. What did you find there?
So I was I was invited to come and meet cocoa farmers in Venezuela because of the work that I've done. And I remember at a certain point emailing with the person who is overseeing the cooperative that said invited me. And I said, you know, I don't think this is a good time. And he said, we don't think there's going to be a good time. Please come. And I was there for 2 weeks, and I had the opportunity to meet people who are really going through an extraordinarily difficult time. I mean, if you think about waking up every day and not knowing if you're going to have water, if you're going to have electricity, if you're going to, you know, be able to get to your workplace because of, you know, another demonstration, you're threatened with physical violence, the volatility of your currency is so crazy that you're, you know, actually trading in a completely foreign currency, which would be the U.S. dollar, that there are all these barriers to very simple things. And I'm so humbled, honestly, to see that this variety that you were describing, Criollo, it's a different kind of cocoa bean. So first of all, the reason that I love this crop so much is because I've been eating it my whole life, but when I went into the forest, I couldn't identify it in nature, you know? And it's this funny looking bumpy pod, and you crack it open, and then there are these pulpy bits, you know? And what we consume in chocolate are the seeds. We ferment and dry and roast and process these seeds into this glorious substance that we know and love. And most of those seeds are like a purple color when you break them open, and they're really bitter. Like, there's no sensation of chocolate anywhere near this fruit. But the Criollo seeds are white, and they're quite precious in terms of how they're grown and also in flavor. It's a really delicate flavor. I know we kind of tend to think of chocolate as one flavor, but it's just as complex as wine, if not more complex, actually. The number of aroma compounds that have been identified has been more than that of wine. And so you can get all these great flavor notes out of cocoa if you allow for them, you know, if you don't want them processed for consistency. So when it comes to Criollo, it's like caramel, it's nutty, it's dulce de leche, it's this really particular fine flavor. And you think about all these challenges in Venezuela, and then there are these farmers and these chocolate makers, you know, because it's getting increasingly difficult to export that cocoa, who are working with this product and just making world-class chocolate. I mean, I can't say enough how impressed I was by the entire group of people I met from you know, farm to bar, who are supporting and sustaining this crop because they recognize what they have. You know, this is a cocoa that's endemic to Venezuela. It's precious, it's delicious, and they're not letting it go despite all these challenges.
A very precious commodity. We're talking with Simran Sethi, who has traveled the world reporting on cocoa farming and the chocolate industry. We're getting insights on where our chocolate comes from and how cocoa is sourced. You can join in. Do you care about certification labels like Fair Trade or Rainforest Alliance? Do you think they're good, or do you think they don't go far enough? Is it important for you to know about the people who produce your food? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Simran, chocolate is a more than $100 billion industry, huge industry, but most cocoa farmers, as you mentioned, are in poverty, and the vast majority of cocoa farmers work at the margins. Where do the children come in? What is happening here about child labor?
Well, it's a complicated situation, so I don't want to give any impression that this is an easy problem to solve, because it does fundamentally come down to structural poverty. It is something that we can address, but right now there are about, 2 million children working in cocoa, and the average income for cocoa farmers in Ghana and Ivory Coast, the top three producers in the world are Ivory Coast, Ghana, and Indonesia. In West Africa, research shows that farmers earn less than $1 a day. So while we have had legislation, specifically the Harkin-Engel Protocol that was developed back in 2001, that was, the goal of that legislation, and that's U.S. legislation, was to eliminate the worst forms of child labor. And in response to this, there was a nonprofit forum, the International Cocoa Initiative, and the idea was that we would reduce child labor by 70% by 2020, right? So when you're back in 2001, 2020 is far enough away that you can make these commitments and then just sort of nudge them along. And then progressively, that's exactly what's happened. All these major chocolate companies that said, oh, we're not quite there yet with our targets, we're going to push this down the road a little bit further. But in order to achieve these targets, you're going to have to tackle poverty. And in order to tackle poverty, you're going to have to be willing to redistribute the wealth. This You mentioned $100 billion goes into the confectionery industry. So that includes, not only chocolate bars, but think of anything that has chocolate in them, chocolate covered stuff, bonbons, et cetera, et cetera. And if you're not willing to reallocate some of those profits, you're not going to see the kinds of changes that we need. So I think that's something that's really important for consumers to remember. And also the fact that, this stuff doesn't exist in a bubble. This is about getting consuming countries, so governments like the United States, governments across Europe involved, and saying, like, we need this to change, as well as governments on the ground. So
You
it's
need
it needs to be a
cooperation.
comprehensive, exactly,
Cooperation
effort.
among governments. And certainly these companies have to have then buy-in, not just from the US, but from, these communities in Africa.
The US is important because so many of the major manufacturers are headquartered here, and we're also a major consumer. Americans eat about 10 pounds of chocolate per year. So it's not like we aren't important in this and we should, like sort of throw up our hands and say it's not our problem. It very much is, but it's certainly not ours alone.
We're exploring certification labels, the government relations, responsible sourcing of cocoa. Simran Sethi has traveled the world reporting on the chocolate industry, on cocoa farming. Do you care about where your chocolate comes from? Do you think labels like Rainforest or Alliance are keeping the marketplace ethical, or do they not go far enough on regulation? Where do you buy your chocolate from and why? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a moment with journalist Simran Sethi right here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show this Thanksgiving. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and our focus is chocolate. You probably have some within arm's reach right now, and it's no wonder it's one of the world's favorite foods. The global chocolate industry, as we said, worth about $100 billion. And according to the National Confectioners Association, it takes about 400 cocoa beans to make 1 pound of chocolate. So we're looking at the supply chain, how the cocoa is sourced. With your questions, do you think about where your chocolate comes from and whether its main ingredient is sourced fairly? We're at 800-642-1234. The Slow Melt podcast host Simran Sethi stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Willie is joining us from St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Willie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm really thankful that you're tackling this, because it's an important issue. But I think what I my idea was is that personally, I don't really care about the sourcing, the big global issues. There was a story about jewel pods and those getting thrown away, the story prior. So it's hard to, for me, like as an individual, to take that pressure on as the consumer. But I'm really glad that people see the issue and people like you are out there, you know, addressing it.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Well,
like,
I think
I don't care. I'm glad you have it.
Yeah, Willie, it makes a good point at the consumer level. You know, what should we do when we look at these problems in the food industry and especially here around chocolate? What do you do as a consumer?
Absolutely. And thanks, Willie, because that is, if we're keeping it real, you know, it is a challenge. We're all trying to balance a million things. But I think one thing to start to pay attention to is how much are you paying for a chocolate, right? And we've been conditioned to think that this should be a super cheap product. But let me tell you, it is so incredibly difficult to grow, to process, and to make chocolate. Like, I am so humbled and grateful that there are people out there doing all of this, farmers and amazing chocolate makers, because this substance brings me so much joy. And here we are on Thanksgiving, and I think some of the quick things that we can do is start to look at, this is told to me by an economist, actually, from the International Cocoa Organization, look at the percentage of cocoa in your chocolate bar. If you're really committed to keeping this crop going, then choose a higher percentage of cocoa. Also, move toward some of these more specialized chocolate makers. Craft chocolate is a really fuzzy term. There's no kind of oversight over it, but these are the makers that are really committed to flavor, right? So when you think about something like, you know, a large scale bar that you'll find like at the checkout counter in a drugstore, that's really about consistency, right? And a tremendous sugar high. On legally, you know, a chocolate bar that is named chocolate has to have 10% cocoa content. But when you're looking at some of these craft chocolate makers, you're talking about, you know, upwards of 50%, 60%, 70%, and onwards of cocoa content, right? So having a higher percentage of cocoa means that you're going to, of course, be supporting cocoa farmers a bit more, and thinking about the price that you're paying and thinking about what it is actually worth to you. Because one of the things that really struck me when I was in Ecuador, specifically writing my book, was meeting a farmer named Vicente Norero. And what he said to me was, "You're eating my story. You're eating my history and my work and my hopes and my legacy." And that has been so profound for me. I can't do this with every food. But if I can find a few that I really care about and start to consider what that supply chain looks like, there's ample information online. You can look at a bunch of things I've read and see what we can start to do to make this shift. Because without consumer engagement, it's not going to happen. You know, and it might be as simple as shooting an email off to, you know, your favorite chocolate company. It might be getting curious about, you know, different kinds of chocolates, tasting different places, right? You'll see origins. A chocolate from Madagascar, you know, with cocoa from Madagascar will be very different than one from Ecuador. One, the Madagascan, will be tart and fruity, you know, have these great undertones. You know, the one from Ecuador might be more brownie-like and fudgy. I mean, there's a whole world to explore here that is crazy packed with flavor. And that deliciousness is something that we can also use as a springboard for supporting a more sustainable cocoa industry.
Well, let's take another call now. Lori is joining us from Hale's Corner. Hi, Lori. What is your connection to this industry?
Well, I am so glad I got to talk to you. Stephen Wallace has been, well, I call him a friend of mine. He was an exchange student from the United States that went to Ghana.
Ghana. Yep.
He stayed there. Yep, he stayed there for quite a while and loved it, and he wanted to do something for it. And they have a wonderful source of chocolate there. But the people there didn't get a whole lot of income from it. They got to pick the cacao beans, you know, but they didn't get to have a plant and process it and distribute it. You know what I'm saying?
Well, it sounds like, because, Lori, that you have more of a personal connection, you think about chocolate differently. Is that true?
It is. And it's a little pricier. I think they've had a few problems with the cacao product up the plant. You know, there've been weather conditions that have given it a problem over in Ghana. But he is Steve Wallace has gone around and he's talked about beyond fair trade, and I think that that's still another thing we should be thinking about. Don't you?
Lori, yeah, thank you. What can we do on the issue of fair trade?
Well, certifications are a great first step. So if you're standing in front of the chocolate aisle and not sure what to do, look for some of those certifications. Organic certification is specifically about the chemicals that are put onto the crop, right? So I don't want to conflate these things. Fair trade is the most established certification. It requires that cocoa traders pay farmer cooperatives, not individual farmers, a minimum price plus an additional premium for their crop. But what research has shown, and this is research from Fair Trade International, is that even farmers who are selling cocoa with fair trade certification are many of them are still below, their household earning is still below the World Bank's extreme poverty line. And so, again, this goes back to a bigger system. So I would say if that's your first point of entry, definitely look for certifications. There's, you know, there's Rainforest Alliance, which also looks at a lot of the environmental challenges. There's Fair Trade. This is a great first step. Those certification protocols are not focused on flavor, right? And they are looking at farmer cooperatives. I would also suggest looking at some of those smaller direct trade models, the one that Lori mentioned that Steve's doing. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Steve's trying to manufacture chocolate at the origin, which is also incredibly important. Look and see, where is your chocolate made? Look and see, is there a percentage listed? Because when you see this information, an origin or a percentage, you can start to think these are signals, right? This company is trying to tell you something about the place and about the people behind the bar. And if you're going to stay in the like 99, you know, or $1.50 realm, you're probably not going to be moving toward a organization or a company that's trying to pay more fair prices. But there are extraordinary companies out there that are doing really, that are working very, very hard to try to elevate farmers as not only like these early players in the supply chain, but central to our experience of chocolate. So look at the story and start to pay attention. And I think what you'll find is, you know, it's going to enhance your chocolate making experience. That was one thing I really loved hearing when I was researching another chapter of my book on cocoa, and it was, on coffee. And, yeah. And, you know, an expert said to me, like, a delicious cup of coffee is only delicious if it's just, you know, if it's fair and it's made well. And I know that farmers were also cared for in this process.
Well, we only have a few moments left with you, but I want to just touch for a moment on the environment and deforestation. Is that an issue for making room for more cocoa farms?
It is, because most certainly, production has increased, but what we're seeing is that production has increased at an extraordinary cost. So in there's an incredible NGO called Mighty Earth, and they did satellite mapping in Indonesia, in Ivory Coast, in Ghana. And what they found, like, for example, in Ivory Coast, is it's lost 85% of its forests between 1990 and 2015. And Ghana stands to lose all of their remaining forests outside of its national parks in the next decade. So this is another problem that we need to kind of look at and tackle. The solutions are out there, but it takes economic and political will and consumer persistence to make it happen.
Simran, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Simran Sethi is creator and host of the podcast The Slow Melt. She writes about food sustainability and social change. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.